You're listening to Big Cast, your source for financial technology innovation.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati from 154 Advisors here on behalf of Best Innovation Group, where, as you hopefully know by now, we like to do cool things with financial technology for credit unions, fintech companies, community banks, and we like to talk about it here on a weekly basis with some people that we find have some great additions to the dialogue in the industry, in the fintech space. So hopefully you've been following along. And if you haven't, please take a look back at the archives. There's lots of interesting conversations that we've had over the course of the recent weeks. You can find out more about the Best Innovation Group at big-fintech.com. You can find me on Twitter at 154advisors. And I am officially today declaring the industry conference season, at least the fall industry conference season, to be over. I just got back from my fourth conference over the course of the last 7 weeks. There always tend to be a bunch of them kind of from late September to mid-November. This one was, for my purposes at least, a little bit different, a little bit of a different space than I tend to go to. The AFP conference, AFP 2018, which took place in Chicago. AFP is the Association for Financial Professionals. It's a little bit more focused on corporate businesses and also the banks selling into the corporates and their treasury operations, payment operations, things along those lines. AFP as an organization is actually the accreditation body that does the designation for the CTP, the Certified Treasury Professional, as well as a certification for corporate financial planning and analysis, the FP&A. I've been to these before, but it's been a few years, so it gave me a kind of a fresh perspective on what's going on, and they're still going strong. About 7,000 people got together in Chicago in, it was actually over Election Day, which I found interesting. Hopefully all those people voted early at some point in their home states before they took off. But good sessions, great exhibit hall floor, as I said, with a little bit of a different twist than I've been seeing recently, given that it's more corporate-focused than consumer-focused, as a lot of the shows I go to. And a lot of really fascinating side conversations that I've probably got even more out of in terms of talking to some of the businesses and understanding more what they're thinking on a regular basis about how they manage the point of sale in terms of payment and reconciliation and things like that. One of the big recurring themes over the agenda and on the exhibit hall floor is the whole notion of real-time payments. RTP that the clearinghouse is working on, to a lesser extent, same-day ACH that Notch has been doing. And it's, to me, a real mix of the old and the new. Definitely a lot of interest in real-time payments and interest in blockchain and what that could do for things as well. But at the same time, as you're going to hear from a couple of these interviews, still, you know, the old tried and true stuff. Cash has not gone away. You don't see as many checks at the point of sale, but you sure see a lot of them in terms of mail-in orders and things like that. So there's still a lot going on there. Another thing that was different to me that I very much appreciated, while having these kind of on-site conversations, just kind of randomly catching up with people at breakfast or lunch or in the hallway or whatever, I had three different people when we started talking about the podcast and the BigCast that they pulled out their phone and on the spot went out to iTunes or Stitcher and subscribed right there, which of course is really gratifying. And we usually save that little comment till the end of the session, but let me say that right now. If you haven't already, would really appreciate if you'd go out to Stitcher, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe to the BigCast, B-I-G-C-A-S-T. People who were doing that, they very quickly see a few different tiles come up on their screen. BigCast Financial Network is what you wind up seeing. It's green and white. Subscribe. Hopefully you will not regret it. Another thing that I'll mention that came up during the show, AFP awarded what they call the Pinnacle Award to recognize innovative solutions in treasury and finance. They first narrowed down the finalists to a group of three companies with some new solutions, all more internally focused. That's not fair. They're not really internally focused, but they're not commercial products being sold per se, like you might see at a Finovate or something like that. The two semifinalists, I guess the people who did not win the final award, but made it to the final three, and I think deserve a notice as well. BMC Software came up with a financial planning and analysis tool homegrown for their own in-house use, a solution to help with their sales forecasting and understanding new versus renewal sales, license versus maintenance sales, Didn't get much detail on that, but obviously anything that can help, having been in that world before, anything with license sales and software forecasting, always a challenge. Hopefully they did something that could really help out that team. And then another company called OpenText, which put together a treasury management process, which managed to integrate their cash management. They, through a series of acquisitions, had over 400 accounts at over 120 banks. In many cases, people start to look to consolidate those for reasons. Again, I don't have all the details. They're still running an awful lot of banks, but they put together a process that simplified that dramatically. But what I found really interesting was the winner is something that you've probably heard about already. And it was Uber and their instant pay product for their drivers that allows their drivers to basically cash out, not have to wait till the end of the week, or if they don't want to, not even to the end of a shift. And on a regular basis, hourly, if they choose to, they can have their accumulated funds deposited into their account for a small fee and really a very nominal fee. I think it's 50 or 75 cents or something like that. And I think that is especially in the gig economy, a great innovation. And one of the things that really strikes me about that is that this has only been in the market for less than a year. And it already is one of those things that's like, well, yeah, that's obvious. Why haven't we done that before? I mean, it almost doesn't feel like an innovation because it seems so intuitive. And to me, that's exactly what we're looking for when we're looking at innovation. Something that really serves a need, clearly a need, and it just becomes so logical that you don't even really think about it anymore. I was just yesterday listening to Brian May, the guitarist. Oh, hey, look, we got music into the episode again. The guitarist for Queen and the new biopic about Freddie Mercury, Bohemian Rhapsody, and talking about the fact that Brian May, who's, by the way, if you don't know, an astrophysicist who has published books, he has a PhD in terms of astronomy. But he is the writer. He's credited as the writer for We Will Rock You. And he made that point. And it made me think of AFP when I was listening to this. You know, the boom, boom. You know, the We Will Rock You. It's like, it feels like it was just kind of always there in the ether. It's like, did someone have to write? The answer is, yeah. It's incredibly intuitive now. And that's innovation. When you've got somebody who comes up with something so fundamental, but nobody did it before. I remember the same comment when Mike Judge started doing Beavis and Butthead and it became popular. And I think he was interviewed on David Letterman, if I'm not mistaken. And David's like, that's incredibly primitive. I could have done that. And Mike Judge said, yeah, but you didn't. Yeah, it's accurate. He was the one that came up with it. It may seem incredibly fundamentally basic, but that's one of the beauties of innovation. Anyway, we digress a bit. I focused primarily, there was a lot of corporate treasury type sessions. There's leadership development, things like that. But not surprisingly, given my background, I focused mostly on the payments track. Went to 7-8 sessions in that category. In one that I really found interesting, here we go again. The other thing I was going to mention is I've gone back and listened. We've been doing these series of episodes where we've interviewed people on site at Money 2020 and Finovate and BAI Beacon and all these. And as I've listened back to myself, I've started to cringe because I never realized how often I say the word. What I found interesting was, and I'm going to try to stop that tick, but obviously I'm failing already as we start off here. Anyway, a session I found really cool was a payments track one featuring several people, including Starbucks on board, and a company that I was not familiar with the parent company's name, but run a series of footwear companies like Famous Footwear and Allen Edmonds and run those retail operations, talking about how they get paid at the point of sale and the challenges they still see. But after that session, I caught up with Bob Mira, who's a senior analyst at Celent, one of the name brands as far as research in this space, about some of the things that he's found as far as challenges and the continuing importance of things like cash. Let's have a listen with my conversation with Bob Mira. Glenn Cervona here at the AFP conference with Bob Mira, who was just on stage talking about the fact that cash continues to be one of the big challenges for merchants at the point of sale. Bob, thanks so much for taking the time. You made the comment that you were sitting next to somebody, the treasury ops manager from Starbucks, and that Celent is not nearly as much of a household name. I'd like to think that with our audience, they probably know you almost as well.
Yeah.
So I thought, some of the comments you were making, I've kind of felt this way for a while. You pointed out out that the level of cash has obviously come down in terms of use at the point of sale, but it's kind of leveling off. It hasn't really been dropping dramatically recently. That's the numbers you're seeing?
Yeah, well, it depends on what you measure, right? So, Glenn, if you measure currency in circulation, which arguably only grossly correlates to utilization because there's a lot of stashing of cash
exactly,
going on.
Especially overseas.
By foreign concerns. But so cash circulation continues to grow handsomely.
Mm-hmm.
Cash as a percentage of the payment mix overall has been stubbornly resilient, right?
Yeah.
Declining ever so slightly, you know, a percentage point or so. A year. And I mean, for perspective, right, 15 years ago, cash was about 40-45% of the mix, and now it's in the high 20s, right? So still a marked decline, but over a shorter time horizon, not so much so. I don't see a cliff,
And you made the point also that if you're, you know, got 1 foot in boiling water, 1 foot in freezing water, you're, on average, you're comfortable. And you've still got the issue that by geography, by demographic, you know, by small dollar purchase versus large dollar purchase, there's, right. you know, significant variation in the way it's used.
Yeah, for sure. And big variation among merchant verticals, right? So, and for gambling, it's quite high. For cannabis retailers, it's right. virtually 100%.
They have no choice in that case.
Well, part of it is, I think, a desire on the buyer side to be have some anonymity, but it's also the fact that because the dealership happens to be afoul of federal regulations, as far as I understand it, it's tough for them to get a banking relationship.
Exactly.
So they are a bit hamstrung. So we could call that an outlier, I suppose.
Well, you were on stage, as we said, with Starbucks and also Caleres, which I was not familiar that they're a holding company with on top of famous footwear, Allen Edmonds, and a couple of other shoe stores.
Yeah.
So they've got a higher average ticket size. But it was interesting that even they still continue to see close to 20% as a percentage of transactions, not as I understand it, not percentage
not
of dollars.
Yeah.
And Starbucks as well, still, and again, it's a small dollar value, and they've done an amazing job in terms of people, probably more than anybody else, moving people onto the app.
Absolutely.
But they're still at 23% cash.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about while we were off mic around the notion of people, you know, what it's going to take to move them to mobile wallets, per se.
Something compelling.
Yeah.
Well, we're all creatures of habit, right? And so credit cards are not a new thing, and credit card adoption is pretty high, right? And arguably, one key reason is for all the rewards programs, right? And as I've recently looked at some data that showed the favorable growth of overall credit card transaction volume over the last 5 years, but also the substantially higher rate of spend to fund these reward programs, right?
Yep.
And it doesn't look sustainable to me, right? There's only so much interchange to spread around.
Right.
And if you're rewarding consumers for it, well, that's less that the issuers and the card networks get. So it seems to me at some point we're going to see that level off and reach a glass ceiling. And then the question is, you know, what else could cannibalize cash? Probably not debit. That's not a compelling notion. Mobile payments have yet to be compelling, and arguably they're more likely to cannibalize the alternative card utilization, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But still use those same rails. And checks have long since dwindled at
point of sale.
So
yeah, exactly.
what's left yet?
And you know, and you just mentioned interchange as well. One of the interesting points that was made was that interchange is just flat out right there on a piece of paper. You can look at it, and I believe it was the Starbucks gentleman said it's not scalable. I mean, it doesn't scale. You know, you continue to pay pretty much the same rate. You do more transactions,
right? Unless you're a massive retailer, right? You can't utilize your size to negotiate lower fees. But with cash handling, you can. That's a logistics business, and if you've got a large number of stores, you can negotiate lower pickup fees. Although those are not insignificant either, and go directly to the bottom line.
And those are things that are invoice driven. But a lot of as you made the point that a lot of the cash handling fees, and this has been the argument for some time, you'll kind of get lost in the sauce. It's just it's a piece of people's workday.
It is, and I think you made a very good point to say, all right, so if you're going to accept cash, and most merchants still do, well, there's kind of a fixed overhead. Right? Yeah. You got to have a safe. You got to have handling procedures. You got to make a deposit somewhere.
You got to reconcile.
Yeah. So you do all that stuff. And if you have twice as much cash, well, maybe it's 20% more effort, but it's not linear like it is with interchange fees.
And you see every once in a while, you and I were again just talking about this. You know, the we are a cash-free, you know, name your coffee shop. I know Argo Tea here in Chicago tried to go cash-free a while back, and I know they got pushed back, at least at O'Hare, because there were enough tourists who were just traveling with cash. And there was just something posted on social media, a coffee shop in Norway, you know, we are cash-free. And it was posted saying, oh, I've been seeing a lot of these signs here. And my first thought was, well, we've been hearing that the Nordics were going cash-free for some time. So the fact that they still have to post that sign says to me that maybe it's not as intrinsic, you know, as some people think it is. So if you look in the crystal ball, I mean, what do you think? It's just going to be that continual slow drip? We're not going to get rid of the headache of having to deal with cash anytime soon.
I think so. Speaking of the U.S., right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
I'm sorry, back to the U.S.
I think, I mean, never mind the black and gray market, right, which I'm really not qualified to comment on quantitatively, but it's alive and well, right? But never mind that. As long as such a large portion of our economy is driven by small and medium-sized businesses and so much of our income tax is, or so much of our treasury revenue is driven by income taxes, right? There's going to be a compelling incentive to utilize cash, right? Anybody who's ever been a server at a restaurant knows that that there's great value in cash tips versus credit card tips, right? And that's compelling. And those drivers are real. So until such time, and maybe it's cryptocurrency, becomes sufficiently anonymous to displace cash with a more friction-free alternative, I think it's going to be here to stay.
And whether you want to be a tax cheat or not, I mean, if, like you say, if you're a small business, the point of the session that you were in was, you know, how merchants are dealing with this.
Right, yep.
As long as you've got people still coming in the store that want to pay
with
in cash, it's kind of hard to say, no, I'm not going to take it. And
well,
we don't see any sign that they're going to stop coming in the door.
You pay a price for that, right? And so the idea that merchants so freely accept so many credit cards, particularly American Express, not to pick on them, but it's fairly well known that their interchange is higher. And I've talked to many small businesses who either don't accept Amex or do so with great loathing.
Right.
And why would they therefore do it if not for the preference of their customer? So in retail payments, the payee is in the driver's seat.
And payment preference goes both ways.
Yeah,
exactly. It may be card and it may be cash.
Yeah.
Well, Bob Mir, thanks so much for taking the time. Solent, if people want to find any more, I'm sure you've got some research that's worth them checking out.
We do. We tend to sell that stuff. But we do have a lot of content on our banking blog at www.celent.com.
Great. Have them take a look.
Yeah,
thanks very much.
So thanks again to Bob for taking the time to talk to us. One of the things that as you look at payments in general, and obviously this is something that this is my attempt at a transition. Let's see how it works. Fraud is obviously top of mind on a lot of these things. One of the comments that was made in a session is that small businesses, you know, but defined as ones with less than 500 employees, are disproportionately hard hit by fraud, in part because they don't have the infrastructure to handle it. A couple of other stats that came up around fraud. 29% of fraud schemes, and we're talking, and I think the session was called low-tech fraud. They were just getting back into the good old-fashioned stuff like embezzlement and confidence schemes and check kiting and, you know, inside jobs, most of them being, you know, lone wolves, every once in a while a conspiracy. I think that was something like 85% lone wolves, 15% some kind of, you know, coordinated effort between people. But 29% of those schemes last 5 or more years, which is pretty phenomenal when you think about, you know, whether it's a bookkeeper gone wrong, you know, somebody in an accounting shop, something like that. Another angle of that on risk that I thought a data point that that really stuck with me, 75% of the business IT infrastructure is managed by third parties. So when you think about that, you know, for all the effort we can put into diligence internally, we always are going to be reliant on what our vendors and contractors are doing as well. And the buck still stops with us. If we've decided, we as a credit union or a fintech, to outsource some of these operations, particularly in a regulated environment, you know, the regulators are still going to look to us to make sure that we know that as we're delivering that final product, that the IT infrastructure is on the straight and narrow as well. So something else to think about. And the challenging part of that, 1.8 million was the number that was given of unfilled cybersecurity jobs that are currently in the U.S. You know, obviously, a supply-demand mismatch. If you listen to too much of this fraud stuff, it's got to be a rough industry to be in, because you get a real dim view of society, and you can convince yourself that, you know, everything's going wrong. And I know people who I know in that area, shred every little piece of incoming junk mail, are very, very careful when they mail things. They don't leave it in their mailbox at the bottom of the hill so nobody can take it. Very fundamental things like that. Which is unfortunate, but I mean, I think when you're really exposed to this stuff, you realize just how much of it's going on. In terms of data breaches, also, bad guys typically are in a system for over 6 months before they're detected. And then usually it takes an average of 55 days once they're detected to flush them out of the system, which again creates all kinds of issues around disclosure, which you hear about all the time. Why didn't you tell us earlier that you had a breach? Well, there sometimes can be some very good reasons. Sometimes you don't know they're there. And then once you find out they're there, it's probably a good idea to get them out before you start announcing that. Because if someone realizes they're trapped inside the building, they might do some more damage. So another thing around that front in terms of keeping systems safe, another statistic I heard, 20,000 plus critical vulnerabilities in various software systems have been reported on a year-to-date basis. So that means that those have to be patched. You're not going to do 20,000. Obviously, not every company has access to all 20,000 of those. But which ones do you prioritize? Which ones are the ones that are really going to come back and bite you? Where's the reputation risk? Where's the real risk? It's a tough question. It's tough stuff and very interesting stuff that it's really important we keep our tabs on. That's partially related to my next conversation. This is not data security as far as breaches or inside jobs or things like that. But Claire Green, a good friend of mine that I've gotten to know from the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta, she's been involved. She's talked before about things like the consumer behavior study as far as payments, then keeping diaries on that. But for this purpose, the Fed has recently put out a new fraud study based on information they pick up from the payment study, both from financial institutions and the card networks. And that has just come out in the last couple of weeks. A lot of really interesting stuff in there. And Claire was not on the agenda at AFP, but I saw her in attendance and we'd been meaning to talk about this. So I caught up with her one day and got her thoughts on exactly where the high points are. And I found there to be several very some that just purely kind of confirm what we thought we already know, but now we have good data behind it, and some that I think are a little bit surprising. So let's have a listen. Glenn Servati here at day two of AFP with one of my favorite people in payments, Claire Green from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Thanks for taking the time, Claire.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've recently, is it technically a Federal Reserve Board or Atlanta release, a new fraud study that is out?
That's a Federal Reserve Board study, and I'll just mention that it is an official report posted at federalreserve.gov, but my views today are my own and do not necessarily reflect the views of either the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta
or Major League
Baseball.
Federal
Reserve system.
Understood. I know that's standard disclaimer. And I know it's good stuff. I mean, because I know that this has been a topic, fraud. People would love to have more concrete data to go by. And I think this is about as authoritative as we're going to get. It's around non-cash payments. There's two data points for that, 2012 and 2015. So we're starting to get some trends. And then you've got card payments into 16 as well, correct?
Right. So when we talk about non-cash payments, we're talking about cards, credit, debit, including both prepaid and non-prepaid, ACH transfers, and also checks. And wires, information about wires is collected in the Federal Reserve Payment Study, which is the data source for this fraud report. But we don't talk about wire fraud in this particular study. And in 2012 and 2015, we conducted surveys of depository institutions. And that data is used for the reporting on cards, ACH, and checks. And in 2015 and 2016, we conducted surveys of the card networks. And that data is used for the 2015-16 data, which is focused exclusively on cards. And in both instances, we're reporting on general purpose cards, so private label cards are excluded.
Got it. So you're dealing with two different data sources, but from what I can tell, they align pretty well. There's not a big discrepancy between the two, so you can draw some pretty good conclusions.
Right. Generally, if you look qualitatively, you can see that, you know, there's similarities in the reporting from the both sources.
I guess the big headline we'll start with, and then we can kind of drill into some of the details. You know, fraud is growing both in dollar amount and the number of incidents and the rate, but it's still an extremely small number. I mean, I guess when you actually look at it in percentage terms, 0.0046%. So that's 46 cents out of every $10,000, I think is what I saw from the report.
Yes, that's correct. In both 2012 and 2015, fraud was less than 50 cents on $10,000. We do see an increase, a change over that period, an increase, but you're correct. The numbers themselves are quite small.
And again, just for definitional purposes, I'm sure fraud means different things to different people. What you're measuring is, I don't want to overstate it, oversimplify it, and then give a misimpression. It's fraud that actually clears and settles. So it's not fraud that's intercepted and, you know, diverted along the way.
Exactly. So first of all, we're measuring third-party non-cash payments fraud. So
first-person fraud's out of the mix.
Exactly. So that means there has to be an unauthorized use of the card, account number, etc. So first-person fraud, for example, when a person makes an online purchase and claims the package was never delivered, is excluded. And also, of course, and authorized payments also are excluded. So if a person is, say, a victim of a phishing attempt and sends money via his or her own account and authorizes that payment to be made, that also would be excluded.
I hadn't thought about that. Okay, what about so-called friendly fraud?
You know, friendly fraud we would consider to be first-party fraud, and that's when, say, your family member gets a hold of your PIN or something
like that. So that would not be in here either.
And that also would not be included. And it's important to remember that, of course, much fraud does involve an exchange of money, but not all fraud does. And identity theft, for example, which may be a setup that eventually could lead to payments fraud, also is not included in what we're looking at here. So we're gathering very specific quantitative information about third-party fraud that is both cleared and settled.
So in a nirvana situation where we got absolutely the perfect data we wanted, it would be great to know how much fraud is actually intercepted. It's detected and stopped along the way, but that's not what we're doing here.
That is correct.
Gotcha.
Part of what we're doing is measuring across institutions, across card networks, so we need to have language and definitions that are constant.
That's a good point. Yeah. If you're going to work across it, as soon as you start doing that, different people, you know, track things differently, and you get apples and oranges.
Yes.
Okay. So, and again, one of the main key points here is, not surprising, but this really documents what I think a lot of people suspect. Card fraud is the fastest growing, it looks like, and it's growing faster than card payments themselves are growing, too, correct?
Yes, that is correct. So, card fraud increased from 2012 from about $4 billion in value to $6.5 billion in value. And
so it's more than a 50% increase over 3 years.
Yes.
Okay.
So keep in mind, that's not an annual growth rate. That's
right.
A change
right.
over 3 years. And that, of course, that growth consists of two pieces. First, the fact that there are more card payments generally. And then secondly, the fact that the fraud is occurring there. So what we find is in 2012, about two-thirds of payments fraud by value was represented by card fraud. And in 2015, it was more than three-quarters.
And to throw another kind of nuance in there, not only are there more card payments, but there's more e-commerce and card-not-present payments, which are also more, on a weighted average basis, more susceptible to fraud.
Right. So in 2015, card-not-present fraud, you know, there was definitely a higher rate of card-not-present fraud. Card-present fraud was about 9.3 basis points, and card-not-present fraud about 14.2 basis points. And I just want to remind you that a basis point is 1/100th
right.
of a percentage point. So important to put these numbers in context. And the one other way that you can look at that three-year period is that The card payments overall grew by about 20%, and the fraudulent payments grew by about 64%.
That's the real takeaway.
So that's really what you're seeing is, you know, yes, there's a lot of growth in cards generally, and then also there's a lot of growth in fraud.
On the other side of the coin, ACH, the lowest rate. I mean, that one is, I think, and part of it is probably that you're not dealing with a real-time decision. You've got a little bit more time to take a look at these things. I'm not sure how faster payments is going to impact that, but ACH is the lowest of the rates, correct?
Yes. So ACH has the lowest fraud rate. It's ACH also generally in the payment system represents the highest dollar value
right.
of payments. So this is an interesting framing just looking at card payments, which by number, all card payments, not fraudulent payments, are, you know, most of non-cash payments. But if you look by value, ACH payments really represent the greatest proportion.
Yeah.
So when you start looking at rates, this the very high value of ACH payments comes into play in terms of the calculation of this these rates.
But in terms of sheer numbers, it's still the smallest.
It's definitely, yes, it is the smallest, and you can look at that from a couple of points of view. The first is that the Federal Reserve Payment Study does look at payments by all actors in the economy. So we're looking at not only consumers, but also businesses and government. And you might consider that many ACH payments are made by businesses and government, and that perhaps there are more stronger controls.
And the very original purpose is payroll, right?
So, consumer payment, yeah. Exactly. And the original purpose, which is payroll.
One of the other things I thought was interesting, and I'm not sure how what you take away from this, but I noticed in the study, ACH payments, fraudulent ACH payments, the average value of a fraudulent payment is lower than the average ACH legitimate payment, but the opposite's true on credit card.
Yeah,
in credit card, you actually see the fraudulent ones being higher on average, correct?
Yep. So I'm just going to digress a little bit to tell you the kind of thing that you can find in the report.
Yeah.
I know it's hard in listening to hear all these numbers.
It's good stuff. Yeah.
So for every way that we slice and dice the data, we look at about four different measurements. So the first is the total dollar value and the total number of fraud. And then the second is, and from that, the total dollar value and the total number, you can compute the average dollar value.
Right.
And then we do that also, the same measures for all non-fraudulent payments. And then using that, we compute a rate. So whatever measure you happen to be interested in, can look up all those different elements in the report. So just to backtrack a little bit. And then we do find that the ACH fraudulent payments are by dollar value tend to be of lower value than the typical dollar value of an ACH payment. I know that the dollar value of an ACH credit transfer is about $9,000, the average dollar value. So think about what happens when you're sending high dollar value payments. They might be exposed to more scrutiny.
Yeah.
So if I'm trying to make a fraudulent payment, one way that I can evade, let's say, various detection rules would be to make a lower
dollar
value.
Avoid the spotlight.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the other one I thought was, now that I think about it, as you mentioned the credit payment, ACH credits are have a lower fraud rate than ACH debits as well. The debits, I believe, are actually, on a relative basis, still very low.
Yes.
But they're less susceptible. The debit is more susceptible than credit to fraud.
That is correct. So just think about the way the payment happens. An ACH credit is a push payment where the payor has to send a payment to the payee. And the fraud rate by value of ACH credits was less than half the rate for ACH debit transfers, where in the case of an ACH debit payment, the payee makes the request.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And then the last thing that I found really interesting is the trend on checks. Fraud is actually down in checks. And it's actually, I mean, checks, obviously, as we all know, are declining. But the rate of, you know, the fraud decline is actually greater than the actual rate of check decline itself.
Right. So one thing that's interesting about checks is that the number of checks between 2012 and 2015 did decline. but the total dollar value of check payments increased. So you can perhaps think about that in terms of use cases. Fewer people writing checks in line at the grocery store would lead to, there could still be fewer payments.
When they're still using them, they're using them for the big ticket items.
Exactly.
And more businesses, too, who probably have a higher ticket price as well.
Yes. And but we do find then so that the total number of checks declined, the total dollar value increased, and then by both number and dollar value, the rate of fraud decreased. So I think for dollar value, the rate is about 0.25 basis points. So that means one 400th of a percent by dollar value.
So again, lower than card, higher than ACH.
Yes.
Good. Well, good. So if people want to dig in, and there is more here, it's Federal...
If you go to federalreserve.gov, or if you Google Federal Reserve Payment Study, that's an efficient way for someone who's listening to find this report. You can also look at the federalreserve.gov at the press release postings. There was a press release posted in mid-October. That's another way to get into the data. And at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, there are slides from a webinar that was conducted on November 1st, and they will be posted soon.
That's a good point. And I'm not sure if that one will be out there, but I'll include a link in our show notes so people can go directly to the report and the press release itself.
Oh, that would be great. Thank you.
And as I always associate you also, I know the other project you work on heavily is the diary of consumer behavior on payments.
Yes.
I know there's another study of that in the field right now as well.
So that's correct.
Be looking forward to sometime in hopefully relatively early 2019 seeing that one as well.
Yes, that's a fun project where we all learn how we are like or unlike typical behavior of U.S. consumers.
It's a great excuse to really geek out on this stuff too, which I love. Well, Claire, again, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it.
So thanks again to Claire for taking the time. Then kind of wrapping things up, obviously, as everyone knows, if they listen to the BigCast regularly, we talk a lot about blockchain, cryptocurrency, and things along those lines. It wasn't specifically their topic, but Bill and Dan Carmody were on stage, and I've got to say, I was very impressed. This was the last day, the notorious last session on the last day before everybody, they got their suitcases and they're ready to go. And it's usually, quite honestly, kind of a dreary session. I found myself in this situation recently where I was speaking at the last one, and it's very hard to get the audience engaged when they're kind of looking at their watches and ready to go. Bill and Dan filled the room. There was a session where it wasn't really billed as a capstone, but it was a chance to kind of bring all this stuff together around the fintech challenges facing corporations going forward. The room was full. There was a very active level of questioning, Q&A coming from the floor, and a lot of people waiting to talk to them afterwards. By the way, I think everybody must assume when two people on an agenda named Bill and Dan Carmody are on, that they must be related. And as you'll hear, they're not. They just happened to have discovered that they were both working in relatively similar fields and have decided to team up for some of their presentations. And I thought they did a really good job with it. And afterwards, you'll hear, literally, you can hear the site being torn down. It feels to me a bit like some of the, like if you hear an interview at a football stadium as the field is being vacated after most of the fans are gone. And they touched on some of the possibilities in that area around uses of blockchain and other things that we have to be looking at. So Bill and Dan Carmody.
Clint Cervata here at the wrap-up of the AFP conference with the Carmody brothers.
They're not brothers.
Dan and Bill, which I just assumed, I won't even tell you who I thought was the father and the son, but I thought you might have been a father-son team when I started off.
Oh, boy.
But Dan and Bill, why don't you both just introduce yourselves with your basic lines of work.
Sure. So I'm Bill Carmody. I am a executive leadership coach as well as a public speaker and a writer.
Absolutely. My name is Dan Carmody. I operate Trezolution, which does two primary things. We do treasury management consulting, and we do treasury management training, in addition to being a faculty member at Northwestern and a public speaker.
Okay.
I am.
I'm a Northwestern grad. So.
Oh, okay. Congratulations.
So, and this was the very last session. Usually you get a lot of bleary-eyed people. You had a full room and a very engaged room. So kudos for managing to pull
Thank
that
you.
Off.
Appreciate
we're probably
going
to get knocked out down here by the people who are taking the screen down.
Yeah. Okay.
But having said that, I think it was much more of kind of a capstone conversation about the variety of things going on. And we're always talking a lot about blockchain. So
right.
I thought it would just be interesting to kind of go over some of your ideas. You said you're
We're still kind of in the proof of concept stage, but you had some interesting use cases. I think you both mentioned.
Proof of concept, and I'll let Dan speak to specifically Treasury. We're beyond, when you get outside of the Treasury area, we're beyond proof of concept. So, for example, in the presentation, I talked about how Walmart's using it to manage the farm-to-table aspects of their supply chain. So understanding when there's a recall or if there's actually a problem, that they can go specifically to where the essence of the problem was and only affect those particular products rather than having to take everything off the shelf.
And that was, I mean, I'd heard about the whole notion, but I hadn't really put that together, that rather than get rid of all the lettuce,
right,
all of a sudden it's get rid of these SKUs.
Right.
I mean, that's a pretty powerful opportunity.
And you think about all the waste that they're able to reduce because of that, right? And so that doesn't impact the entire industry. It just affects the specific farms that had that specific salad.
Exactly.
Right.
I believe you were the one that brought up the kind of the LinkedIn comparison as far as employment history.
Absolutely. I mean, the ability to be able to verify employment is important, but more specifically when it comes to the finance side, is that there are financial institutions now that are leveraging or exploring blockchain technology to automate and to make their transactional information more secure. So you mentioned proof of concept before. They are still in the proof of concept phase. And what they are doing is they're doing a lot of internal testing within their organizations in order to, well, prove the concept. Once that concept's proven, then you'll start to see more rollout of client-facing blockchain technology.
Got it. You also made the point, you know, NYSE is an example of, I don't know, that's more RPA, robotic process automation, more than, you know, actual blockchain, I guess. But the actual trading floor is a totally different experience now.
Yes. So it'd be, even 5 years ago, you were still seeing people trading on the physical New York Stock Exchange floor. But today, it's just what we call theater. You know, you walk in and basically it's all about the broadcast shows. It's about the opening and closing bell. But if there's no trading happening on there, right? Because everything has been replaced with artificial intelligence and algorithms. And so any consumer can make a trade and they don't need a stockbroker to basically do a buy-sell agreement. They're doing it in real time. And that's what we're seeing in terms of trends in other industries and other impacts.
Absolutely. If I could just add on to that, it's the real-time component that needs to be addressed first, right? We were talking during our presentation today about APIs, application programming interfaces, right? And the ability for organizations and counterparties to seamlessly transact and transfer data amongst each other. It's once that real-time environment is put into place is when you will start to really see a huge wave of adoption and innovation on the fintech side, utilizing RPA, robotic process automation, and artificial intelligence and machine learning.
Given that you're in the treasury space with your company, I'm assuming you're a finance professor? Is that what
you did? I'm not a professor by trade. I'm a consultant.
You mentioned you're on faculty at Northwestern.
I do. I teach a treasury management course.
It is treasury.
There.
Okay.
Yes.
So you made the comment about financial reporting, again, using
Correct.
The blockchain. And the idea of, you know, there's been actually conversation about getting away from quarterly reporting and making it like less frequent.
Yeah.
You're actually going the other way and saying it can basically be real time.
Well, it's a thought exercise.
Yeah.
And
it's an idea.
Prognosticating as to where potentially something could go with this. If you have the elimination of delay and you have the seamless integration of data, then one might ask, are there changes that could happen in regards to the frequency of reporting, for instance? So that's one area.
I think it's a really good point. It's a thought exercise because I can see hang-ups with it, but it's a great way to think outside the box.
Sure.
We've talked a lot on the podcast before about buy, build, partner. Bill, you made an interesting kind of the way you think about that.
That's right. So what I would say in terms of the build is do what you do best and outsource the rest. And so the idea was, the comment was, is that if you're thinking about whether you should build internally or you should outsource, my general recommendation is if it's something that's core to your business, if it's something that you really want to do in perpetuity, that's something you're building toward a future, then by all means, build it yourself if that's what you think is going to help you. But everything else you should outsource because it distracts from the core of what you're actually trying to build.
If it's just a matter of getting it done and getting it out
Correct.
The show.
Exactly.
This is great. This is a great way for us to do the final, you know, segment for this because you
you're
can
hearing the wrap
hear
up.
The wrap. It reminds me of the very late interview that takes place at a sporting event where the place is already empty and you hear things breaking. If people want to get in touch with you, just real quickly.
Sure. So on Twitter, it's at Bill Carmody, BillCarmody, or just BillCarmody.com.
Okay, great.
Absolutely. And likewise, Tresolution, TreasolUtion. That's at Twitter. Best way to get in contact with me is through the website, Tresolution.com, or I'm always happy to connect on LinkedIn.
Wonderful. Dan Carmody, Bill Carmody, great job. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And with that, I will officially declare the fall 2018 FinTech conference season to a close. If anybody's thinking of any that I've forgotten about that are still coming up in the remainder of November or early December, actually one that I do know is still coming up now that I think about it, which I'm not going to this year. I know I did some interviews there last year. Big Bright Minds, Filene Research Institute, does their annual symposium. If I'm not mistaken, it's out in San Diego or someplace in California this year in early December. If there's any others that I'm forgetting about, drop me a note. I'm not really all that keen on getting back on an airplane and going to another one yet this year, but certainly would like to hear about it. If you go to any more, if you've got any more takeaways that you've seen on any of these, or if you disagree with some of the takeaways we had, we'd love to hear from you. Please drop a note. My email, glenn.sarvati@154advisors.com. You can find me on Twitter at 154advisors. You find us here at Best Innovation Group, big at big-fintech.com. We're here every week with new content on Tuesdays and very often these days to Thursdays as well. So you'll get your fix of fintech information here on the BigCast. Please do follow up with us. Keep tabs, drop a note, let us know what you're thinking. My name is Glenn Sarvati. Thanks again for listening.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big Fintech, email us at info@big-fintech.com, or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.